I realize I'm asking you to take a chance on a proven loser. I mean, I don't have any money or stuff like that, but maybe, hear me out, please. Maybe we could find a cheap, unclean apartment in a dangerous neighborhood and have more kids than we can afford. If we're lucky, maybe a few of them won't be born sickly and disfigured in spite of our genetic histories. Meanwhile, I could find a dehumanizing, low-paying, dead-end job with no benefits while you stay home watching TV and gaining weight. And if things get bad, like if I get paralyzed and you get raped by Mexican sailors and lose your mind and start crying all the time, we can always move in with my parents. They love kids, and their incest counseling is almost complete. And I've noticed Dad's episodes are starting to result in far less property damage than they used to. What do you say, honey? You want to give it a shot? Maybe our second set of HIV tests will turn up negative. If I may renew a theme I spoke to earlier, I have a bit more to say about early boarding on the airlines. It's not just favoritism to the disabled that bothers me, that's unfair enough. But immediately after the various cripples, limpers, and wheelchair jockeys have been unfairly allowed to board early, the airline then has the nerve to allow people with children to get on the plane. Once again, at the expense of the rest of us. I do not understand this policy at all. Why should people board early simply because they have children? What's so special about having kids? After all, a lot of kids are accidents. Many people wind up with children simply because they're unlucky. Is that something we should be rewarding? I don't think being careless in bed should qualify someone for special treatment on an airplane. And by the way, as with the devious methods of the cane and crutch crowd mentioned earlier, I think there are some couples who bring their kids along on a trip solely for the purpose of early boarding. What other reason would you have for including kids on a trip? Enjoyment? Hardly. In fact, and this may seem extreme to some, it's my conviction that there are some couples who have intentionally gotten married and had families specifically for the purpose of getting on the plane early. I know it sounds unlikely to you, but don't forget, these are cold, pragmatic, striving, yuppie boomers. Unsentimental people who largely regard children as props and commodities anyway. Honey, let's have a kid so we can board planes early. Great idea, Scott. You start making a list of preschools and I'll get the lubricating jelly. Believe me, it happens more than you may think. So during this pre-flight, pre-boarding fiasco, after the crippled and the maimed have been safely strapped in, the airline people tell us they will now pre-board passengers traveling with small children. Well, that's fine as far as it goes, but what about passengers traveling with large children? Suppose you have a 6-month-old son with a growth hormone disorder, one of those 7-foot infants with oversized heads that you see in the National Enquirer. Actually, with a kid like that, I think you'd be better off checking him in at the curb, don't you? He'd probably enjoy it in the luggage compartment. It's dark in there. I would imagine he's used to that. But I digress. Forgive me for indulging my weakness for flights of colorful narration. Back to the real problem, people with children on airplanes. Here's how you solve this. You make the following announcement. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a pre-boarding announcement only. We would like to address those of you who, both today and in your lives generally, find yourself burdened with needy and annoying children. We sympathize with you, but as long as you've decided to drag them along with you to Pittsburgh, we wish to minimize the inconvenience of their presence to the rest of us. Here is what is going to happen. First of all, you're getting on last, if there's room. Before that, we're going to board the full-grown humans and allow them to settle in, get comfortable, and have a drink or two. You may be standing out here for an hour or more. Then, you and your children will be swiftly escorted onto the aircraft and placed in a special soundproof walled-off area in the rear of the plane. There will be standing room only. For safety purposes, you will be tethered to one another and secured to the wall with leashes and straps. More than likely, there will not be any food left for you, but your children will be allowed to scavenge the trays of those passengers who did not finish their meals. Aside from that food service, you will be left alone and expected to keep the children quiet. And now, we ask that you please gather your precious creatures around you, and when you hear the whistle, see to it that they move smartly and swiftly onto the plane, remaining quiet and avoiding any eye contact with grown-ups. Thank you for flying the friendly skies of Sensible Airlines. I don't often talk about my own experiences. It's not my style. But I had a recent incident in traffic that I'd like to tell you about. And before I begin, there are a couple of things you ought to know about me. I drive kind of recklessly, I take a lot of chances, I never maintain my vehicles, and I don't believe in traffic laws. And so, because of these practices, I tend to have what a picky person would probably refer to as a lot of traffic accidents. And wouldn't you know, last week I ran over a sheep. Or possibly I ran over a small man wearing a sheepskin coat. I'm not sure, really, because I didn't stop. That's another rule of mine. I never stop when I have a traffic accident. Do you? No, you can't. Who has time? Not me. If I hit something or I run somebody over, I keep moving, especially if I've injured someone. I refuse to involve myself in other people's injuries. I'm not a doctor. I've had no medical training. I'm just another guy out driving around looking for a little fun, and I can't be stopping for everything. Let's be logical. If you stop at the scene of the accident, all you do is add to the confusion. These people you ran over have enough troubles of their own without you stopping and making things worse. They've just been involved in a major traffic accident. The last thing they need is for you to stop, get out of your car, go over to the wreckage, and start bothering them with stupid questions. Are you hurt? Well, of course they're hurt. Look at all the blood. You just hit them with a ton and a half of steel. Of course they're hurt. Leave these people alone. Haven't you done enough? For once in your life, do the decent thing. Don't get involved. Look at it this way. It's none of your business in the first place. The whole thing took place outside of your car. Legally speaking, these people were not even on your property at the time you ran them over. They were standing in the street. That is city property. You are not responsible. If they don't like it, let them sue the mayor. And besides, the whole thing is over now. It happened back there, behind you. For God's sake, stop living in the past. Do yourself a favor, count your blessings, be glad it wasn't you. As it is, there's probably a substantial dent in your fender. So be satisfied, my friend. You got off easy. And I'll give you a practical reason not to stop. If you do stop, sooner or later the police are going to show up. Is that what you want? Waste even more of your time standing around with a bunch of worthless civil servants, filling out forms, answering a lot of foolish questions, lying to the authorities? And didn't anyone else see this accident? Are you the only one who can provide information? Surely the people you ran over caught a glimpse of it at the last moment. So let them tell the police what happened. They were a lot closer to it than you were. There's no sense in having two conflicting stories floating around about the same dumbass traffic accident. Things are bad enough. People are dead. Families have been destroyed. Time to get moving. Chances are you're late for dinner as it is. Now, folks, there are two sides to this. Helping people by leaving them alone when they're injured is one thing. That's my altruistic side. People need to be self-reliant, and I want to do what I can to foster that. But it's often hard for me to drive away from a nice, fiery accident scene, because I have a self-indulgent side, too, and that needs to be honored. And so, on the other hand, if I'm out driving, enjoying a lovely day, and I see a traffic accident, just see a traffic accident, one that I'm not involved in, I stop immediately. I want to get a good look at what's going on. I enjoy that sort of thing. If people are injured, I want to take a look. I am Curious George. Of course, the police don't like that. They say you're rubbernecking and blocking traffic. I say, never mind that rubbernecking shit. I want to take a look. My philosophy? I'm never too busy that I can't stop to enjoy someone else's suffering. I'm looking for a little entertainment. To me, traffic accidents are one more form of entertainment. You want to hear my dream accident? Two buses and a chicken truck getting hit by a circus train in front of a flea market. Entertainment. I'm looking for an antique lamp sticking out of a clown's ass. If I'm going to take the time to stop, I expect a couple of fucking laughs. And if the traffic situation is such that I can't quite see what's going on, can't get a good enough look, I'm not the least bit shy about asking the police to bring the bodies over a little closer to the car. Pardon me, officer. Would you fellows mind dragging that twisted-looking chap over here a little closer to the car, please? My wife has never seen anyone shaped quite like that. Look at that, sugar lips. Those are his testicles hanging from the rearview mirror. Thank you, officer. That will be all now. You can throw him back on the pile. We'll be moving along. And off we go, out onto the highway, looking for a little fun. Perhaps a flatbed truck filled with human cadavers will explode in front of a Star Trek reunion. One can only dream and hope. Here is a letter I received in the mail recently. Dear friend, your name has been provided to us because we have discovered that in spite of America's recent economic problems, you may still have a few dollars tucked away that you're saving for a future financial emergency. Well, that emergency is here. We're hoping you will be sympathetic to our effort and express it with your generosity. Stated quite simply, we're raising money to help the rich and powerful. These hard-driving people continue to require large amounts of money, and most of them are far too busy to attend to this sort of direct appeal for themselves, so we are here to help. The rich and powerful need your financial support in order to increase their wealth and power so they can exercise even greater influence over national events and, of course, over your lives. Remember, these people are small in number and therefore inadequately represented in our system of proportional government. They consequently lack influence and suffer the fate of many minorities, that is, being ignored by the very government they have helped elect. It is for these reasons they have decided to band together to better present their ideas and especially to expand their influence with elected officials. But first, they need your help. They need money. In the first stage, your money is needed for basics: stationery, office supplies, postage, phones, and rent, first month, last month, security deposit. The rich and powerful need to set up a headquarters so they can start really raising money in order to live properly. But once they reach that level, that doesn't mean your job is done. Not at all. In fact, once things are running smoothly, there'll be a continuing and even greater need for more and more of your money in order to provide all of the expensive clothing, imported cars, fine jewelry, gourmet foods, and exotic pets that these people require. That's when your dollars will really count, helping provide the lifestyle to which the rich and powerful are not only accustomed, but entitled. In addition to these considerable personal expenses, there will of course be a need for large amounts of money to persuade and influence the many politicians and government officials who, after all, have financial obligations of their own. Most of these dedicated public servants are underpaid and must find ways of supplementing their income without taking time off from work. Your money, funneled through the rich and powerful, can go a long way toward solving their financial problems, and you will have the satisfaction of knowing you have helped advance the selfless agenda the rich and powerful have laid out in their effort to improve our country. Can we count on you? Will you help? Will you give yourself the opportunity to say you helped the rich and powerful when they really needed it? Do it now. Do it for yourself, and do it for your children. Sit down and write out a check for a substantial amount, even more than you can afford. Make it payable to the Fund for the Rich and Powerful. You'll take satisfaction knowing you've done your part. And you'll be secure in the knowledge that whenever you have a problem, the rich and powerful will always be there to help. Sincerely, Esterbrook Winslow, Somewhere Offshore. P.S. Your canceled check is your receipt. Bob calling. Bob dials a number. Hello? Hi, is this Don? Yeah. Hi, Don, this is Bob. Oh, hi, Bob. Hi. Well, I guess I'll let you go now. Bye. Okay, bye. Bob dials again. Hello? Hi, is this Carl? Yes. This is Bob. Oh, hi, Bob. Hi. Well, you're probably a busy guy. I'll let you go. Bye. Bye. Bob dials again. Hello? Hello, Tom? Yes? Who's this? Bob. Hi, Bob. What's going on? Not much. How about you? Same old, same old. Great. Well, I gotta go. I got a bunch of calls to make. Okay. Bye. Bob opens his phone book and makes a list of more people he wants to bond with. His phone rings. Hello? Hi, is this Bob? Yes. This is Steve. Oh, hi, Steve. How are you? Well, that's the reason I'm calling. Oh? Yes, I'm doing fine. So I thought I'd let you know that and maybe save you a call. Well, that's mighty thoughtful of you. Thanks. That's okay. Well, that's it. I guess we'll talk tomorrow. You got a deal. Bye. Bye. Bob scratches Steve's name from his list of calls and reaches for the receiver. So much still to do. Remember, kids, Mr. Policeman is your friend. Always cooperate with him. Mr. Policeman wants to help you, so you must help Mr. Policeman. Don't forget, if you refuse to cooperate, Mr. Policeman will beat you to death, especially if you're not white. I'm not a person who thinks he can have it all, but I certainly feel that with a bit of effort and guile, I should be able to have more than my share. You know, it would be fun to have a set of twins and name them Dumbo and Goofy, and then just sit back and see how their personalities develop. I bet they'd really enjoy going to school. I'd like to point out that during the 20th century, white, God-fearing, predominantly Christian Europe produced Lenin, Stalin, Franco, Hitler, and Mussolini. Next time you're in an elevator, blow your nose real loud into your bare hands and then ask someone if they have a Kleenex. Or blow your nose into a Kleenex, open it up and stare at the stuff and say, "Wow, look at this, it's all green and yellow." Then show it to the other people. I guarantee you won't pass many floors before you have the elevator all to yourself. I've never seen a homeless guy with a bottle of Gatorade. One great thing about getting old is that you can get out of all kinds of social obligations simply by saying you're too tired. You know who you have to admire? A Catholic hitman who blesses himself just before he strangles someone. I've noticed that a Jew will sometimes use a little paperclip to hold on his yarmulke. Shouldn't that be God's responsibility? I mean, you did your part, you put the thing on. Shouldn't it be God's job to keep it there? Or why don't Jews just wear larger yarmulkes that grip the head better? Maybe with an elastic strap that could go under the chin. By the way, I know a hip-hop Jew who wears his yarmulke backwards. It's hard to detect, but I think it looks great. Suppose you tried to fuck a woman who had 10 personalities, and 9 of them said okay, but one of them resisted and tried to fight you off. Would that still be rape? Where do we go from here?
Who says we're here?
Because of mad cow disease, they're now going to leave certain cow parts out of hamburger meat, including the skull. Well, I don't know about you folks, but I can't imagine enjoying a hamburger that doesn't have at least a hint of cow skull in it. I was looking in the mirror the other day, and I realized I haven't changed much since I was in my 20s. The only difference is I look a whole lot older now.
Here's a safety tip from the fire department. Kitchen grease fires can be quickly and safely extinguished by dousing them with a mixture of benzene and lighter fluid. Apply quickly and stand clear.
True fact. More children in the United States are molested each year than wear braces. I'd like to know the suicide rate among people who call into radio psychologists and actually follow the advice they get. I have no regrets in life, although I am kind of sorry I never got to beat a man to death while wearing a tuxedo. There's a message window that comes up on my computer screen whenever I type in a command the computer doesn't like. It says, "Fuck you, I don't do that." When people use the phrase "call it quits," why do they use the plural? It would make more sense to say, "I'm going to call it quit." I recently witnessed something I'll never forget, an eclipse of the Earth. But because it was an eclipse of the Earth, there was no place to look. So I looked at the Earth, and as I did, the Earth got very dark. But the period of darkness was brief because of how close we are to the Earth. Remember, kids, never look directly at an eclipse. Always get someone else to tell you about it.
The National Rifle Association reminds its members never fire a gun at your own body unless you're trying to seriously injure yourself.
As part of those displays that honor rock stars in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I think they should show the amount of money each artist spent on drugs year by year. Also, it wouldn't be a bad idea to list which drugs the artists were taking while recording particular songs and albums, just so we'd all know.
True fact. In 1733, the Russian army had a treatment for soldiers who suffered severe homesickness. At the first sign of the condition, they buried the soldier alive. That's good. I like people who go right to the heart of a problem.
Do you have any perfectly good possessions you don't need? Send them to Ill Will Industries, where our completely healthy and able-bodied employees earn money by breaking things and rendering them useless. Call Ill Will. Help those who are already doing fine.
I'm in favor of anything that destabilizes the Republic. Regarding the Menendez brothers, my opinion is that you can rarely get two kids to agree to kill their parents unless the parents really deserve it.
True fact. Purina now has a cat food made especially for cats who live indoors. Indoor cat food for indoor cats. Meanwhile, I'm sure you're aware that some human beings have no food at all.
The worst thing about email is that you can't interrupt the other person. You have to read the whole fucking thing, and then email them back, pointing out all their mistakes and faulty assumptions. It's frustrating, and it's time-consuming. God bless phone calls.
I cannot understand a grown man whose name is Fuzzy, and who actually allows people to call him that. Do these guys really introduce themselves that way? Hi, I'm Fuzzy. If some guy said that to me, I'd say to him, well, you don't look very fuzzy to me.
If you vote once, you're considered a good citizen. If you vote twice, you face 4 years in jail. In this country, alcohol is hardly ever seen as a drug problem. Instead, we think of it as more of a driving problem.
Life is simple. Your happiness will be based completely on luck and genetics. Everything comes down to luck and genetics. And when you think about it, even your genetics is luck.
Seems as though I never get to do the foxtrot anymore.
What's going on with these people who tell you to have a safe trip? I would never tell a person that, because if they died, it would really feel creepy.
If I had been in charge of reorganizing the government's security agencies into a homeland defense organization, I would have divided the responsibilities into two agencies, the Bureau of What the Fuck Was That, and the Department of What the Fuck Are We Gonna Do Now?
Don't you get tired of this simple-minded Laura Bush nonsense about children reading, or reading to children, or teaching children to read, or reading to children about teaching, or whatever the fuck it is? What is it with these Bush women? His mother, the big silver douchebag, was into the same sort of nonsense. These women should not be encouraging children to read. They should be encouraging children to question what they read. Content is far more important than the mere act of sitting with your mother and dragging your eyes across text. By the way, I noticed that apparently the idea of teaching children to read didn't work when Barbara tried it on George.
Not all the political manipulation of language is done by the big bad politicians. A lot of it comes from people who think of themselves as good and virtuous. The politically active. Activists. As opposed, I guess, to pacifists, who should not be confused with pacifists, who are, after all, quite often activists. Let's start with faith-based, which was chosen by right-wing holy people to replace the word religious in political contexts. In other words, they've conceded that religion has a bad name. I guess they figured people worry about religious fanatics, but no one's ever heard of a faith-based fanatic. And by the way, none of the Bush religious fanatics will admit this, but the destruction of the World Trade Center was a faith-based initiative. A fundamentalist Muslim faith-based initiative. Different faith, but hey, we're all about diversity here. The use of faith-based is just one more way the Bush administration found to bypass the Constitution. They knew Americans would never approve of government-promoted religious initiatives, but faith-based? Hey, what's the problem? The term faith-based is nothing more than an attempt to slip religion past you when you're not thinking, which is the way religion has always slipped past you. It deprives you of choice. Choice being another word the political speech manipulators find extremely useful. School choice, and the more sophisticated version, parental choice, are code phrases that disguise the right-wing's plan to use government money to finance religious education. If you hear the word voucher, watch out for the religious right. Again, though, be alert for the more sophisticated term for vouchers, opportunity scholarships. It's impossible to mention the word choice without thinking of the language that has come out of the abortion wars. Back when those battles were first being joined, the religious fanatics realized that anti-abortion sounded negative and lacked emotional power, so they decided to call themselves pro-life. Pro-life not only made them appear virtuous, it had the additional advantage of suggesting their opponents were anti-life, and therefore pro-death. They also came up with a lovely variation designed to get you all warm inside, pro-family. Well, the left wing didn't want to be seen as either anti-life or pro-death, and they knew pro-abortion wasn't what they needed, so they decided on pro-choice. That completed the name game and gave the world the now classic struggle, pro-choice versus pro-life. The interesting part is that the words life and choice are not even opposites, but there they are, hanging out together, bigger than life. And by the way, during this period of name choosing, thanks to one more touch of left-wing magic, thousands of abortionists' offices were slowly and mysteriously turning into family planning clinics. And on the subject of those places, I think the left really ought to do something about this needlessly emotional phrase, back-alley abortions. We don't want to go back to the days of back-alley abortions. Please. It's over-descriptive. How many abortions ever took place in back alleys? Or, okay, in places where the entrance was through a back alley. Long before Roe versus Wade, when I was a young man, every abortion I ever paid for took place in an ordinary doctor's office in a medical building. We came in through the front door and took the elevator, the three of us. Of course, as we were leaving, the elevator carried a lighter load. Then there's the fetus unborn child argument. Even leaving aside personal feelings, the semantics of this alone are kind of fun to unravel. To my way of thinking, whatever it is, if it's unborn, it's not a child. A child has already been born. That's what makes it a child. A fetus is not a child because it hasn't been born yet. That's why it's called a fetus. You can call it an unborn fetus if you want. It's redundant. But you can't call it an unborn child, because, not to belabor this, to be a child, it has to be born. Remember? The word unborn may sound wonderful to certain people, but it doesn't tell you anything. You could say a Volkswagen is unborn, but what would it mean? The fanatics have another name for fetuses. They call them the preborn. Now we're getting creative. If you accept preborn, I think you'd have to say that at the moment of birth, we go instantly from being pre-born to being pre-dead. Makes sense, doesn't it? Technically, we're all pre-dead. Although, if you think about it even harder, the word pre-dead probably would best be reserved for describing stillborn babies, the post-born pre-dead. By the way, I think the reason conservatives want all these babies to be born is that they simply like the idea of birth. That's why so many of them have been born again. They can't get enough of it. Here's some more left-wing nonsense, this time from the environmentalists, the folks who gave us the rainforest. Save the rainforest. They decided to call it that because they needed to raise money, and they knew no one would give them money to save a jungle. Save the jungle doesn't sound right. Same with swamp. Save the swamp. Not gonna work. Swamp became wetland. Nicer words, sounds more fragile. Save the wetlands. Send money. But I think the environmentalists still have their work cut out for them when it comes to global warming and the greenhouse effect. As I see it, these terms are far too pleasant for people to get all worked up about. For one thing, global is too all-embracing for Americans. It's not selfish enough. Isn't globalization that thing that's been stealing our jobs? Global doesn't make it. And warming is such a nice word. Who wouldn't want a little warming? Similarly, Greenhouse effect will never do. A greenhouse is full of plants and flowers, full of life and growth. Green equals life. House equals shelter. The greenhouse effect sounds like something that gives you life and shelter and growth. You're never going to turn something like that into a villain. And the environmentalists have another language problem, this one concerning nuclear energy. Meltdowns. They like to warn us about meltdowns. But a meltdown sounds like fun, doesn't it? Sounds like some kind of cheese sandwich. Would you like some fries with that meltdown?
Here's some more of the distorted language of political persuasion. Conservatives oppose gun control. Liberals know control is a negative word, so they call it gun safety. That's about what you'd expect, but it's hard to find words to describe the following distortion. Some of the pro-gun people are referring to gun control as victim disarmament. Isn't that stunning? Victim disarmament. It takes your breath away. Like a gun.
Liberals call it affirmative action. Conservatives are less positive. They refer to government-mandated quotas, racial preferences, and unfair set-asides. Rich Republicans want to keep their money in the family, and so the Republican Party began to call the inheritance tax, a pro-tax term, the estate tax, a neutral term, which they later changed to the death tax, an anti-tax term. When liberals talk about spending, they call it investing or funding. Funding means spending money. We need to do more to fund education. On the other side of the ledger, when Republicans need to raise taxes, they call it revenue enhancement. The energy criminals now refer to oil drilling as oil exploration. Instead of Mobil and Exxon, they'd rather you picture Lewis and Clark. When the original Enron story was developing, Bush's people referred to the crimes as violations. They said a review might be necessary, but not an investigation. So I guess if the other guys do it, it's a crime that should be investigated. But if your guys do it, it's a violation that should be reviewed. Liberals call it global warming. Conservatives call it climate change. If you want the individual to sound shady and suspicious, you call him an Iraqi. If you want to upgrade him a bit, he becomes an Iraqi American. If you're trying to clean him up completely, you call him an American citizen of Iraqi descent. When people came to this country primarily from Europe, they were called immigrants and refugees. As they began arriving from Latin America and the Caribbean, we started calling them aliens. Some of them are here illegally. Those in this country who sympathize with that group don't call them illegal aliens. They refer to them as undocumented workers or guest workers. Sometimes they're identified by the purely descriptive term, the newly arrived. Most favored nation trade status was considered too positive a term for China, so it was decided instead to call it normal trade relations. Aside from the language, there's no difference between the two policies. The Nazis referred to the extermination of the Jews as special action. In their version, the Jews were not killed. They were resettled, evacuated, or transferred. And the dead were referred to as the no longer relevant. In Palestine, Arabs refer to the areas Jews have taken over as occupied territories. Jews call them disputed areas. The Israelis call their assassinations of Palestinian leaders focused thwartings, pinpoint elimination, and preventive measures. At one time in Iraq, Saddam Hussein called the hostages he was holding his guests. Countries we used to call rogue nations are now referred to as nations of concern, so we can talk to them without insulting them outright. But as a result of bad behavior, North Korea has been downgraded from a state of concern to a rogue state. Likewise, failed nations are now called messy states. Underdeveloped countries have also been upgraded. They're now developing nations. And finally, during the election that defeated Manuel Noriega in Panama, There were groups of thugs that wandered around beating and killing people and looting stores. They called themselves Dignity Battalions. If you enjoyed my earlier description of my new system for wishing people a nice day, perhaps you'll be interested in the following equally innovative method I employ in similar situations. The difference is that this attempt to relieve the tedium of short exchanges involves the replies I give as opposed to the good wishes I offer. As an example, when someone asks me how I am, I try to make my answer as specific as possible. I'm not the type to toss off a casual, "I'm fine." I take care to express my exact condition, and thanks to my creative flair, I can choose from a number of options. If I'm in a self-protective mood, a simple guardedly well often does the job. I find also tentatively keen doesn't give too much away. Of course, if there's the least bit of doubt, I simply rely on my old standby, the ever-cautious, "I'm fairly well, comparatively speaking." That works nicely, especially if I feel I genuinely have something to hide. If I wish to be a little more open, "I'm semi-dandy, thank you for inquiring," is effective and has the added advantage of acknowledging the other person's contribution to the exchange. By the way, should it be one of today's trendy kids, I'm quick to drop a hip and with it moderately neato in order to show that I'm really a cool guy and not just some old fuddy-duddy. Once again, with moderately neato, I reveal only a limited bit of information. But sometimes I'm having one of my really great days, and I'm in a jaunty and expansive mood. In these situations, I tend to throw caution to the wind and express my full feelings. Innocently enough, some person will inquire, "How are you?" And he has no idea what's coming. So I give him both barrels. I lean forward, look him squarely in the eye, and hit him with a quick and cheery, "I'm good, well, fine, keen, dandy, swell, and excellent. And might I add, fabuloso." Believe me, I've bowled over more than one unsuspecting inquirer with this sudden volley of positive energy. Just so you know, I'm prepared for other situations as well. If someone says, "Have a nice weekend," I never say, "You too." Because I never know if, perhaps by the time the weekend rolls around, I will have other plans for that person. Come Friday, I may wish to have them slain. And I never say a Merry Christmas to you and yours. I don't like the possibilities suggested by that use of the possessive pronoun yours. One never knows when the other person may be a slave owner. I certainly wouldn't want to encourage that sort of behavior. One last thing. My stingingly clever remarks sometimes extend to retail encounters. When the supermarket checkout person asks, "Paper or plastic?" I often say, "Woven silk," just to keep him on his toes. Rolled steel is not a bad answer either. I'm happy to pass along to you these methods of mine for making the world a better place. I hope you use them wisely, and may I be so bold as to say, have an excellent immediate future. I find it bothersome that on some radio and TV interview shows, once the host says, "Thank you for being here," the guest always thinks he has to say, "Thank you for having me." It's not necessary. All that's needed is a simple, "You're welcome," or "Nice to be here." Having people on is what they do on interview shows. They're looking for guests all the time. There's no need to thank them. And the same is true of radio call-in shows. The people who call in say, "Thank you for taking my call." Why do they bother? Think about it. Taking calls is what these shows do. They're call-in shows. They take calls. That's their function. Why thank them for doing what they can't avoid? It bothers me that people even think they need to say these things. It's all very insincere. And on the subject of insincerity, let's not forget the nonsense that telephone operators are ordered to say by their corporate drone bosses. Keeping in mind, of course, that telephone operators are not operators anymore. They're attendants. Telephone attendants, or telephone representatives. I've also heard them called communications facilitators and customer care professionals. Anyway, these operators used to say, "Who did you want to speak with?" Now it's, "How may I direct your call?" I don't like that. Sounds artificial. And it has a ring of self-importance. How may I direct your call? Jesus, everyone wants to direct. It's not just actors anymore. And when you tell them who you're trying to reach, they say, "Thank you, it's a pleasure to forward your call." Sounds polite, doesn't it? It's not. It's insincere. And on the subject of telephone operators, another complaint I have about these people takes me back to my original point, the unnecessary overuse of thank you. These days, I think there are far too many thank yous being thrown around on the telephone. Thank you for this, thank you for that, thank you for something else. I find myself being thanked for everything I do, and then some. I recently called a friend who was staying at the Marriott. He was staying at the Marriott. I called him there, at the Marriott. I intentionally dialed the number of the Marriott, because that's where I expected him to be. The connection went through. Guess what the operator said? Right. Thank you for calling the Marriott. Well, what did she think I was going to do? Call the Hyatt? He was staying at the Marriott. Wouldn't do me much good to call the Hyatt. We all know what they're going to say. Thank you for calling the Hyatt. They even thank you for doing things you can't avoid. Did you ever have an operator say, thank you for calling the operator? I've had that happen. Well, what did she think I was going to call? The night watchman? Chairman of the board? Jesus! Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's annoying. One time at a hotel, I wanted to get my car. Naturally, I needed to call valet parking. I noticed a little plastic card next to my telephone. It said press 9 for valet parking. I was about to press 9, but then I noticed I didn't have to press 9 because right there on the phone, one of the speed dial buttons had a little picture of a car next to it and it said valet parking. So I pushed that button. The one that said, valet parking, the one with the picture of the car. Somebody answered. You know what he said? Right. Thank you for calling valet parking. Well, fuck. Didn't he know that if a guest wants to retrieve his car, he more or less has to call valet parking? That's where the cars are. And doesn't he know the designers of hotel telephones have gone to a great deal of trouble to make it easy for people to get their cars? I had simply taken advantage of their skills. I had called valet parking by pressing a single button, a button marked with a little picture of a car. And I can assure you, folks, if I had thought for even a split second that valet parking didn't have my car, for instance, if I'd thought the bartender had it, I would have called the cocktail lounge. I would have pressed the little button with the picture of the martini next to it, which, of course, would have given the bartender a chance to say, "Thank you for calling the cocktail lounge." One further complaint. These days, if I call a hotel from the outside, the telephone operators waste an awful lot of my time. Hello, thank you for calling the Lincoln Plaza Hotel Resort and Conference Center. My name is Tanisha. Have a nice day, and how may I direct your call? And I say, I'll have to get back to you. I forgot why I called. Sometimes, just to scare the operator, I'll sob. It's too late. He died. Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's too much. Occasionally, a recording will thank me. Thank you for using AT&T. How can this be? Isn't gratitude a personal feeling? Recording devices don't have personal feelings. Do they? No, but I do. And I feel this showy hyper-politeness must be stopped. Thank you for listening this far. Wouldn't it be interesting if the only way you could die was that suddenly your head blew up? If there were no other causes of death, everyone died the same way? Sooner or later, without warning, your head simply exploded. You know what I think? I think people would get used to it. I believe people can learn to take anything in stride if they think it's unavoidable. Picture a bunch of guys singing Happy Birthday. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Charlie. Boom! And Charlie's head blows up. But all the candles go out, so it's actually a form of good luck. And everyone applauds. Of course, there'd be an occasional downside. God, another head? That's two this week. I just had this suit cleaned. But we'd learn to deal with it. Let's say you were sitting in a restaurant with your girlfriend, and the waiter was reciting the specials. Tonight we have the marinated bat nipples on a bed of lightly sautéed panda assholes. Boom! The waiter's head explodes. I'll bet you wouldn't miss a beat. Honey, did he say bat nipples or cat nipples? We better get another waiter. And some fresh salsa. I'm not eating this stuff. He was holding it when he blew. So anyway, I'm allergic to bat nipples. I think I might go with the free-range penguin dick. Or the deep-dish moose balls. How about you? Wait, hold still. and a little piece of eyebrow on your cheek. There, I got it. By the way, honey, what wine goes with brain?
When I watch news tapes on TV of the Intifada from Palestine, and I see the Arab kids throwing stones at Israeli tanks, I always have fun watching for the kids who are left-handed, because left-handers have a kind of natural curveball. It's really interesting. I can't wait till Major League Baseball comes to the Middle East. Incidentally, I also noticed that Arab kids usually throw in a high arc, whereas the Catholic kids in Northern Ireland throw more of a line drive. Either way is all right with me, as long as they're accurate. Kids are great.
Hi, I'm Bud, president and head doctor of Bud's Medical Center. Come on into Bud's. This weekend we're having a special on head injuries. Any sort of head injury you got, from a black eye to a completely caved-in skull, just $1.50 this weekend at Bud's Medical Center. We'll also give a free estimate to anyone who's bleeding. So if you're sick, injured, diseased, hurt, maimed, disfigured, or just plain don't feel good, come on into Bud's Medical Center. Bud's, where all the sick people go.
Wouldn't it be weird if they just buried you alive when you got to be 65? If that was the deal for everyone? Right after your 65th birthday party, they came and got you and dumped you in a big pit with a bunch of other people your age and threw in all your birthday presents and buried you all alive. Wouldn't that be weird? Jesus, I'm glad they don't do that. That would be weird. But sooner or later, we'll have to do something like that. We'll have to. We can't take care of old people as it is. And there are going to be millions more of them. Good early medical care is a mixed blessing. It leads to too many old people. What are you going to do with them? No one wants to take care of them. Their children put them in homes. Even the people whose job it is to take care of them in the homes don't give a shit. They abuse them. No one cares. It's my belief that sooner or later we're going to have to start killing old people before they become a burden. One good thing, though, we'll save a lot of money on Social Security and maybe the country won't go broke. There's always a bright side.
The custom of observing a moment of silence before an athletic event to honor dead people strikes me as meaningless and arbitrary, because if you'll notice, only certain people get this special treatment. It's highly selective. Therefore, I've decided that someday, when the time comes that every single person in the world who dies receives a moment of silence, I will begin paying attention. Until then, count me out. It's ridiculous. Here's what I mean. Let's say you live in Cleveland and you decide to go to the Browns game. There you are in the football stadium with a hot dog and a beer, ready to enjoy the action, and a somber-sounding public address announcer interrupts the festivities, intoning darkly,
"Now, ladies and gentlemen, we ask that you remove your hats and join us in observing a moment of silence for the 43 unattractive, mentally retarded, overweight Bolivian dance instructors who lost their lives this morning in a roller coaster accident at an amusement park near La Paz. Apparently, they all stood up on a sharp turn and went flying off, willy-nilly, into the cool, crisp morning La Paz air, and, being heavier than air, crashed through the roof of the funhouse, landing on several clowns, killing them all and crushing their red noses beyond recognition." Snickering is heard in the crowd. The American announcer continues, "And ladies and gentlemen, lest you think this amusing, lest you think this a time for laughter, I ask you please, please, to put yourself in the place of a bereaved Bolivian who may be seated near you this afternoon. Try reversing places. Imagine yourself visiting Bolivia and taking in a soccer game. Imagine yourself seated in the stadium with a burrito and a cerveza, ready to enjoy the action, and a somber-sounding Spanish public address announcer interrupts the festivities, intoning darkly,
Señores and señoritas, we ask that you remove your sombreros and join us in observing un momento de silencio for the 43 mentally retarded, overweight, unattractive American meat inspectors who lost their lives this morning in a Ferris wheel accident at a carnival near Ashtabula, Ohio."
The Spanish announcer continues,
Apparently, the huge wheel flew out of control, spinning madly, flinging the poor meat inspectors off willy-nilly into the hot, humid Midwestern air. And being heavier than air, they crashed to the roof of the carnival freak show, crushing the dog-faced boy and destroying many of his chew toys.
And let's say as you sit there in La Paz listening to this, you find yourself seated next to some Bolivian smartass who's giggling and poking his friend in the ribs. May I suggest you'd be highly pissed at this lack of respect for Americans? And might I add, rightly so. And so, ladies and gentlemen, considering the many grieving Bolivians who may be seated among you today, and trying to keep in check that normal human impulse to laugh heartily when another person dies, let us try again, really hard this time, to observe a moment of silence for the 43 unattractive, mentally retarded, overweight Bolivian dance instructors who went flying willy-nilly off the roller coaster in La Paz, not to mention the poor unsuspecting clowns who at that time were innocently filling their water pistols. You can see the problem either announcer would face. The fans would simply not be able to get into it. But I understand that. I can empathize with the fans because, frankly, I don't know what to do during a moment of silence either. Do you? What are you supposed to do? What do they expect? Do they want us to pray? They don't say that. If they want me to pray, they should ask. I'll pray, but at least have the courtesy to make a formal request. But no, they offer no guidance, no instruction at all. I honestly don't know what to do. Sometimes I resort to evil thoughts. I wish my seatmates ill fortune in days to come. I fantasize about sitting naked in front of the Lincoln Memorial and becoming sexually aroused. I picture thousands of penguins being hacked to death by boatloads of graduate students. More often, though, I wind up bored silly, searching for something to occupy my thoughts. One time I inventoried the pimples on the neck of the man in front of me, hoping to find one with a hair growing through it so I could quietly pluck it out during the confusion of halftime. On a happier occasion, I once found myself staring at the huge but perfectly formed breasts of the woman to my left, her fleshy mounds rising and falling softly in the late October sun, and my thoughts turned tenderly romantic.
Holy shit, look at the fucking knobs on her! Great fucking knobs! I think I'm gonna go to the refreshment stand, buy myself a weenie, and hide it in my pants. Then, during halftime, I'm gonna whip out the weenie and force her to watch while I eat the bun and stuff the weenie up my... Nah. She's probably one of them uptight chicks who think I'm weird. She doesn't know the problem is I'm shy. Those are my thoughts, and I can't help it. During a moment of silence, my imagination runs away with me. I don't know what to do. And why is it silence they're looking for? What good is silence? The ones being remembered are already dead. They're not going to wake up now. Why not a moment of screaming? Wouldn't that be more appropriate for dead people? Wouldn't you like to hear 60,000 fans screaming? Ah! It sure would put me in the mood for football. And one more criticism. Why honor only the dead? Why this favoritism? Why not the injured as well? There are always more injured than there are dead in any decent tragedy. What about them? And what about those who aren't dead or injured, but are simply treated and released? How about, if not silence, at least a moment of muffled conversation for those who were treated and released? It's an honorable condition. Personally, I've always wanted to be treated and released. Usually I'm treated and detained. Perhaps it's for the best. Concerning this whole terrorism thing, there are some misnomers at large. One of them is domestic terrorism. When they talk about domestic terrorism, they often cite the Oklahoma City bombing. But that wasn't terrorism. Terrorism involves a series of acts intended to put a civilian population in a state of panic, fear, and uncertainty in order to achieve some political goal. Oklahoma City wasn't terrorism. It was payback. Revenge. Timothy McVeigh wanted to punish the federal government for what it did at Waco and Ruby Ridge. Revenge, not terrorism. Another one, terrorism expert. Television news channels will often present some guest they identify as a terrorism expert,
but you can take one look at him and see that he's clearly not a terrorism expert. He's a guy in a suit who obviously works in an office, and I say he's not a terrorism expert. You want to know who's a terrorism expert? Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the people they hang around with. Those are the terrorism experts. Has this guy in the suit ever blown anyone up? No. So why is he a terrorism expert? I'm sure the TV people would say, well, because he's made a study of terrorism. Ah, I see. So really, he's an expert in the study of terrorism, the subject of terrorism. But can he make a suicide vest? Fuck no. And if he can, he should make one, put it on, and press the button. Then he'll be a real terrorism expert, like those people he now only reads about. Here's another one. Suicide bomber. Nuh-uh. Sorry to disagree. It's anything but suicide. A person who commits suicide is someone who places no value on his life. My life is worthless. I am going to end it. These so-called suicide bombers don't feel that way. They feel their lives are worth something, and that by giving them up, they make a statement to the world, furthering a cause they believe in deeply. In their eyes, their lives, when sacrificed, have value. And by the way, the suicide bombers themselves don't call it that. In a stunning example of euphemism, they call it a sacred explosion. Holy smoke! Then there's Bush's version, homicide bombers. And in spite of what Bush